Page Fright is recorded on the traditional unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Page Fright. My name is Andrew French. I'm on Twitter at TheAndrewFrench, and this, of course, is the only podcast I host. I'm very excited to have you back for another episode featuring a very fantastic guest whose work I've only recently come across, but I'm really excited to talk about. It's really getting to the end here of February. I'm sitting down to record this on February 27th with the goal of getting it out today before the month ends tomorrow. And we'll see whether or not I do that, but I apologize for the wait on this episode. We actually did the interview a couple weeks ago, but things have been crazy, and I have not had time to edit an episode. So I sat down today, it's snowing here in Vancouver, and just hunkered down and went through this episode. And honestly, I think it's a really cool episode. I think there's a lot in here, and when I look back on it, now a couple weeks after we did the interview, I can say I had a lot of fun doing this episode. And not that I don't always have fun, but this was a particularly fun episode, and it just felt light and enjoyable. We talk in here about queerness. We talk about gender identities and identity in general, and it's just a really good time. Today's guest, of course, you can tell from the episode title, is Charlie Petch, a fantastic writer who's living currently in Toronto. I came across their book, I think I mentioned this in the interview, but if not, then here I go, in Victoria about a month or two ago, and read it on my trip and on the ferry home and was going through everything. And just, you know, where I've been in my journey with gender, I do think, and I believe as well that I said this in the interview, that this book kind of came into my life at a good point. And it's been a really long couple months of figuring out my gender identity, and longer before that, where I was doing so on my own, kind of privately, and not being vocal about it. And so finding work by writers who I feel I can relate to is really meaningful in the moment that I'm in right now in my life. And I think it just is kind of the power of the works that we're talking about on this show, is that, you know, you kind of, at least for me, I sit down to talk to people on this show whose work really strikes me and has some sort of impact on me, and Charlie's book is certainly no exception. I just feel like I kind of stumbled across this book at the right time, and you know, sometimes, like, a little behind the scenes, people will, like, pitch a book for the show and be like, yeah, can you read this, and then maybe, like, have me on and we'll see what happens. And, like, sometimes they do come on the show. In fact, often they come on the show. But sometimes this organic picking up a book in a bookstore and falling in love with it immediately is just the best way for me to interact with literature. And so today's episode was very refreshing and fun for me. I really enjoyed it. Actually, the past couple of episodes have been structured that way, and I've come across the work that way. So it's a real joy to sit down and be in front of a microphone right now talking about it. You're like, Andrew, shut up. It's been it's been way too long of you talking about your gender and all of this stuff and how you came across the book. We want to hear about the book. We want to hear about the poems. So let me tell you about the poet first. Charlie Petch is a disabled, queer, trans-masculine, multidisciplinary artist who resides in Toronto. A poet, playwright, librettist, I think I'm pronouncing that right. I'm not good with music, but I believe that's a musical term. Musician as well, lighting designer, and host. Petch was the 2017 Poet of Honor for the Speak North National Festival, winner of the Golden Beret Lifetime Achievement in Spoken Word with the League of Canadian Poets in 2020, and founder of Hot Damn, It's a Queer Slam. Petch is a touring performer as well as a mentor and workshop facilitator. Their debut poetry collection, Why I Was Late, which came out with Brick Books, I believe last year, and is the subject of today's episode, won the 2022 Relit Award and was named Best of 2021 by The Walrus. Their film with Opera QTO, Medusa's Children, premiered 2022. They have been featured on the CBC's Q, the Toronto International Festival of Authors, and were longlisted for the CBC Poetry Prize in 2021. here I am having a delightful conversation with Charlie Petch. Okay, so, a monthly podcast, and this is this month's episode for February. I read a book that I loved. Surprise, it's kind of how these episodes come to be. This one is by Charlie Petch, and Charlie is here to chat about it. Charlie, how's it going?
It's going pretty good, Andrew. How are you?
You know, I'm okay. I'm really excited to talk about this book. I read it over a trip to Victoria. So I live in Vancouver. I took the ferry to Victoria, picked up your book there. I got an autographed copy, which either means you've been to Victoria or I lucked out. Have you been? I'm assuming that's how it got autographed.
Yeah, I went in October. I was out for the Vancouver Writers Festival, and I usually tour at West once a year, so I turned it into a bit of a tour. So I showed up at Munro's and signed a bunch of books while I was there. So it's pretty cute that you picked up one of those books. You got it at Munro's, yeah?
I absolutely did. And speaking of cute, the cutest, I guess it's an inscription or like dedication or whatever that you wrote on this. Hey, how nice of you to take me home, I thought was adorable. And definitely helped sell the book a little more than it was already sold. So that's great.
Nice. Yeah, I like to personalize books that I'm never seeing anybody buy.
I know it's a bit of an awkward thing, but I think that's a great way of doing it. So we have both read your book, me because I read it, you because you wrote it. But there may be people listening who have not read this book. And so for them, would it be possible? I know, it's crazy.
Ridiculous.
I don't know what they're doing. But for their convenience, could I get you to read a piece for us?
Sure. And I know you, I would also love like one of the pieces that I read to be one that you would like to hear me read. Is there anything?
Oh, definitely. Okay, hold on. What did I flag? I dog-eared everything, and then I put stars on some dog ears that I really
Oh my
liked.
God.
Okay, here we go. What about Transilience? I really like that.
Oh yeah. That's, I was thinking about Transilience just because of our pre-conversation.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Transilience. Oh, there it is. Okay, great. I should mention that if anybody wants to watch this, I recorded this with Daily Extra for a Trans Day of Don't Kill Us, or whatever we're calling it now, but just like Stop Killing Us. Okay, so this is called Transilience. Trans is waiting for your name to get called while the teams go ahead and play the game on top of you. Gender fluid is the shiny new car that your parents think is a wreck and will never let out of the driveway. Non-binary is rehearsing how to exit the bathroom stall in a way that will get you past the four men surrounding it, but not incite their violence. Gender non-conforming is running up to cis people asking, "Is this how you felt in your skin this whole time?" while they stare at your high five until your arm withers. Transmasculine is walking well behind women so they don't get worried while evading men who follow you too closely. Fluidity is taking out the pin from the "How can I help you?" grenade and hearing the answer click on retail floors. Coming out is revisiting the library in your brain and closing so many books that had remained open waiting for answers. Trans is listening to your child self. Trans is whispering to your child self, "I'm so sorry I didn't listen to you. Let's give you the life you deserve."
Amazing. Thank you. And I really love your reading style. I think it's so fun. And it's actually one of the things I was wanting to ask you about. Was sort of... Well, the voice of these poems, okay, and your humor and everything is very upbeat, and it makes things lighter, which is really nice because a lot of the subject matter of these poems it can be pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to ask about that, and kind of like how that functions for you. How do you see humor working in your poems, and especially when you read it out loud? Is that something you're keeping in mind?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like I'm a performer first and foremost, I would say. I don't know. Between the two. But yeah, I'm a performer, and so like I hear, because, and I'm a spoken word artist, right? So I hear what it's supposed to sound like in my brain, and I also anticipate like a live audience there. Mm-hmm. And I think about the best way to give people messages, and I feel like, you know, much like oxygenated blood, like you just need like a nice little host in order to like bring the I've been doing a lot of bleeding lately, so I think about it a lot as of late. And so, you know, it's so humor is such a great way, you know, it's like the foreplay to the brain to like give them the message that you want. And because when you are laughing, you're open to ideas in a way that you're absolutely not when you're not laughing. And you know, that's what satire really feeds on. It's like, you know, actually, you know, that when you're laughing, you're more open to new ideas, and also the fact that you might have been wrong before, because it's such a generous way to receive information that's hard, that I feel like you almost trust the teller more.
Yeah, it does sort of bring, like, I don't know, in poetry, there's a lot of talk about, like, capital P poetry and, like, how, you know, mm-hmm. the speaker is, like, really above the reader or blah, blah, blah. But I feel like the humor helps sort of level everybody on the same sort of stage, in the sense that, like, it equates the speaker to the reader. And it sort of, for me, one of the things I love in a poem is when somebody admits that they don't know the answer to a question they're asking. and I get that sense of humor that comes from that sort of, helps to plant us on the same level as the speaker and make the poetry feel more accessible. So that was something I really liked in your work that stood out to me for sure. One of the things I also wanted to ask about is, right before we started recording, I said, I gave you a bit of a spiel about the podcast and said I started this so that I didn't have to pay for an MFA, so that I could ask people about poetry and get their answers. And you mentioned you never did an MFA. So I wanted to ask you, Charlie, how did you come to poetry and writing?
Compulsion mainly. Okay. I guess like when I was a little kid, so you can probably hear I have a lisp. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, my lisp was much more pronounced, so lateral lisp. So I sounded like this. So, and we moved around a lot. So I'd show up in the middle of school year, you know, looking like a little boy, with a girl's name, and then I would say, you know, then I would speak to everybody. And I would immediately become the most popular kid. Okay, no, I didn't. They would just beat me up, right? Like, so I learned not to speak. And I did that. I did, like, the fifth new school I went to, I stopped speaking for about, like, 2 years, I think, and lived in my head so much and read absolutely everything I could. Like, I was an early reader because it was somewhere to escape to. And certainly, you know, creating your own fantasy world where you are Bambi, is also a lovely thing. And so many, I was really popular with invisible friends. Like, I had a lot. so I guess like I came into poetry as a way of really just sorting out what the hell was going on all around me without being able to say things out loud, I think. And I was like an early writer of everything. But poetry, you know, poetry's truth, you know, it's telling your own truth. For me, poetry, you know, the best poets are honest people. Poets shouldn't be afraid to tell the truth. And I love to tell the truth. I love to question things. And so really, like, it's such a medium for who I am, to be, you know, brave, get up on stage and say something that people are uncomfortable hearing, but you never know who's, you know, in the audience. I actually made someone, I did a poem about transness, but it's actually not in this collection. But at a wedding in Michigan in 2016, and I changed some people's minds about their votes for Trump. They decided not to vote for Trump. So,
wow.
You know, that's that's my whole career is worth it now.
that's a big mind change to have from a single poem. That's pretty impressive, I'm not gonna lie. I should mention too, like when I was growing up, I often forget, but I did have a lisp most of my primary school years at the very least. And I don't remember how it went away, but I had braces really young.
Oh, okay.
When I got braces, they put this little like gate behind my teeth that kept my tongue from going forward. So it wouldn't lisp. And so I just learned from that gate, I guess, to like,
oh my gosh,
say my S that way. And I don't know why I've completely repressed that until just now. So congratulations on finding that out with me.
No problem. But, are you going to start lisping now that you like, you're like,
maybe
wait,
I should reclaim it a little bit.
I've been thinking about creating a clown, like, I study clown, right? I love clown, Buffon clown. And you're supposed to like get a clown character. And I realized the other day, I'm like, my clown character should be my old lisp, you know, and just be me and like do my, you know, poetry, but have like a more pronounced lisp. And like, you know, it's such a disability exploration in many ways. Cause like, oh, you know, you're going to think this is hilarious cause I have a lisp, but like, you know, many people have a lisp, you know,
A
lateral lisp, because I like drool and stuff like that. Like when I would do it, it's a fairly, it's a hard lisp to overcome. That's for sure.
Yeah. You mentioned you came to Poetry 2 through spoken word in a way, like you were involved in that. And I wanted to ask if you happen to know of the spoken word poet, George Watsky.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's got a little lisp.
Exactly. That's why I bring him up, because he had a poem that was titled S is for Lisp. And I remember listening to that when I was in maybe like grade 10, 11, and just sort of starting to come to poetry. And like Watsky was a huge reason I came to poetry.
Right.
Was because I was like, oh my God, a white nerd who's just reclaiming coolness through poems. What an incredible thing that I can somewhat relate to. And so I had to ask if you happen to know of that poem, because it just reminded me of that.
Totally. I've never been able to like completely lose my lisp like George has been able to, but I really appreciate people talking about it. And like, you know, even like looking at, you know, Joe Biden has a stutter, you know, like Amanda, oh gosh, I'm forgetting her last name, but she's a spoken word poet that did the inaugural poem. She's got
Amanda Gorman.
Right? Amanda Gorman doesn't say the letter W like how most people say it, you know? So it's like these little powerful moments are like, oh no, you can be a spoken word artist, like, and have a lisp, you know? And like,
and there's some real power to that too, because of the fact that it is all about language and audible language, right? And so twisting it in that way is really cool. But anyway, okay, so we're still on topic, but we're slightly veering off of your book, which I do want to talk more about. And perhaps we can get back into your book through a question I have for you from my last episode's guest.
Okay.
So, Charlie, your book's been out for a little bit now. And so I don't know if you would consider these earlier poems or not. I'm sure it took you a long time to write, so some of these poems are probably from earlier stages in your writing career. But Yvonne Blomer was my last guest, fantastic Victoria poet, very fitting. And she is wondering, she didn't know I'd be talking to you, but when you read your earlier poems, what are your first three thoughts or responses? Basically, how do you feel about your earlier work?
Usually I'm like, oh, see, I was trans the whole time. and then like, weird, I was married. And you know, I have a drawer full of like teenage angst poems that I don't know. Like, I guess my first impression for most of my old work is like, oh yeah, I was trans. Like I was saying it all this time.
Interesting. Yeah, I find that fascinating. I mentioned in our last episode that I recently have started coming out to people as non-binary, which is this. Yeah, hooray. It's a big change. But what it has given me is a way to look at my old poems differently. I have two chapbooks out, and the first one at least was very like, here's some critiques of masculinity and why I don't feel like these work for me. And then now that I look back, I'm like, oh yeah, why didn't I realize, like, that was years ago, I should have picked up on this. So I can relate in a way to what you're saying. And some of those poems too that you mentioned, like poems about marriage and that sort of thing, are actually in this book too.
Yeah.
So these things carry through. What was it like kind of combining those earlier poems with newer stuff?
Yeah, I guess like it became a chronology. So it's not, you know, this isn't like my life story. It's a whole bunch of different things, but like it's really like, you know, by the end of it, I'm out. Yeah, I guess like looking back on it, how was that?
Yeah, like what was the process like putting together poems that were a bit earlier or about earlier stages of your life with more recent writing?
Yeah, I guess it was, I mean, like for one, you know, like the heaviest part of my process, honestly, was, you know, when I'm naming people in my poem that I am honoring them, you know, even if I'm critiquing. And, you know, I write about my ex-husband who died. And so, you know, part of my process was actually going back to his family, who I know, who are like, we're family forever. And just saying like, hey, I've written some poems. They're, you know, they're not always going to be great about your brother. But I feel like I've honored him, you know, and like, I kind of write poems that they can walk into a room and not feel targeted by, you know, or not feel like I'm disrespecting their uncle. So I floated it around to his sisters and his nieces and nephews, and everybody was fine with it. So that was like, because they trust me. So that was a huge part of my process. Yeah, also just like, you know, kind of wanting to, I got uncomfortable with some of the poems. I'm like, well, that's what I believed then, but I don't believe that now, you know, about gender, how I'm experiencing my gender, going from experiencing, you know, being raised to be a female person to where I am now. And I had a couple of poems where I'm like, you know, maybe I'll take that out of there because it doesn't feel like who I am now. But in reality, you know, it's good to show the before and the after, and not ignore the uncomfortable middle of that process.
Yeah. And you know what? So I spoke with Yvonne last episode, obviously, and we were talking about her question. And one of the things that I mentioned is this sort of, I guess it's like a short story of that I have told many, many times on this podcast, but I will tell to you and I'll bore my listeners with it by quickly saying my grandma once told me that if I don't agree with a poem that I wrote earlier, that somebody will still relate to that because they'll be at that stage of their life, right? Now I have since filed that away, and I come back to that quite a bit, that sort of statement. But I think this example of your book and my life is a very good example of this, because there are probably things in your book where you are like, I don't know if I still believe that about gender or myself, but that might have been things that I was underlining, like, oh yeah, these lines are absolute bangers. This is what relates to my life. I'm sure that this is exactly what my grandma was talking about, I think.
Yeah, that rang true for me. Yeah. Thanks, Grandma.
Yeah,
Thanks, Grandma.
But yeah, so I definitely related to a lot of the stuff about sort of uncertainty that was coming out in this book. And obviously there's always an element of uncertainty. I think at least in my experience of transness, there has been an element of uncertainty. And so I don't know if that goes away, but over the course of the book, it seems like some answers are found through these poems, or at least some really important questions are asked. And that was something that helped me sort of realize that, okay, if I keep asking the questions that I'm asking right now, both in and outside of this book, then I might eventually find an answer to at least one or two of them, which is sort of kind of what you need to hear as somebody who's newly exploring gender.
Yeah.
So it's very helpful. Again, though, making it about me, so I'm going to get back to your book. I wanted to ask, so you mentioned for the first poem that there's a video out there of you performing it. We talked about. And so I want to talk about one thing that I found really interesting right from the start of the book, which was that you often in here describe, I guess, desired or ideal musical accompaniment for the poems.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to ask about that. How did you decide that those were the things that you would have to accompany the poems? Like, is that through you actually doing it, or just sort of like, hey, this would be cool? Okay, so it is through you doing it, through practice.
Yeah, and it's like, it's funny because, you know, as a spoken word artist and a performer and musician, like, it's hard for me to write, you know, the Dear C-3PO poem and not let people know that, you know, if yeah. I'm playing this live, this is how it's going to sound. These are the instruments. And I feel like, you know, if I, you know, that was a very late add to add, like, you know, the liner notes on like the instruments used for, you know, the, what I want you to be hearing while you're reading this. And I think it made my collection really stand out because nobody does that I've heard of or known. And it really created an atmosphere of listening, I think, which is something that I want to spark in a spoken word collection. I also ended up doing an audiobook probably like 7 months, maybe. Maybe about a year after it came out. So I ended up doing a live music performance for all of the poems that promised it. So if you're like, I wonder what that would sound like with the dulcimer and bacon bits, you know, you can listen to my audiobook. And I actually did it. It was so nice. That's, I'm like, oh, it's like an audiobook album, really.
Yeah.
Like 17 of the poems have music. That's all pretty like original as far as, you know, public domain and everything.
I'm going to ask you what might be a very difficult question, but I think it's important because I always wonder this when I'm reading a book. So you've answered this at points in your book. The question I'm hoping to ask is, what music do you think I should be listening to while I listen to the book as a whole? Like, is there like an album that I should just have on repeat? And I'm going to add the rule of it can't be yours. So if it wasn't the music that you have in here, and that you've included in the audiobook, which I will immediately download after this is recorded. Then what album should I be listening to while I read these or others of your poems?
Maybe like Calexico de Descamino.
Okay, I have no idea what it is.
Calexico is like this this amazing band from Tucson, Arizona. They generally have like mariachi bands up with their bands. It's very eclectic, very like sort of spaghetti western sort of feel to it. And that's their, like, they have an album called Blacklisted. No, that's Nico Case's album that they worked on. Anyway, they have an album where these are like all the instrumental extracts from it. So Calexico Descamino. And true little story, when I joined my big ass cowboy band, I always wanted to open up for Calexico. And when my big ass cowboy band kicked me out of the band, which essentially was for like not, you know, not sleeping with any of them anymore. Okay, that's my short, funny answer. I'm sure there's lots bigger answers, but like the next night, like 3 days later, I'm at a Calexico concert and Dallas Green was there, and lovely Dallas. And he was like, oh, I heard what happened. He's like, because we were like, us and the Sadies were like brother sister bands kind of. And he was like, you should like meet Calexico and then you should bring your saw down here and you can play with them tomorrow night maybe. And that's absolutely what happened. So it's like, you know, I'm like, oh, this like thing I really like dreamed about with this band happened without the band and right at the right moment for me to feel like I'm still in the music industry. You know, it was just, it was so beautiful. So they're already my favorite band. And then that happened. I'm like, you're my favorite band forever.
That's so cool.
I know.
What a great time too, to have that happen in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I was devastated. I was so devastated. Like, they broke up with me on my answering machine. I was like, oh this is so hard to tell you this. It's like, is it? Like, to get it all in before the beep? I don't know. Like,
but then a week later, you can call them back and be like, hey, sorry I missed your message. I was opening for this band that I love. So things are kind of crazy. You know, I don't know if you've heard of them. It's just this, like, insanely cool band.
Well, we rejoined years later, and they actually did two of the songs that are on the album now. They also broke up and then got back together to do the music for the Owen Hart poem, the wrestling poem.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, and the Chewbacca poem, they did the tango for it.
Okay, so listeners now who might not have read this, which again, what are you doing? But if you haven't read it, you're probably like, wait, okay, so Charlie has mentioned Chewbacca, C-3PO, and Owen Hart now. What is this book of poetry about? Because we open with this.
Masculinity.
Right. Okay, so I wanted to ask too, and maybe we can get into a reading after this question, because it might help. But you use pop culture in your poems like a lot. Like there are often references to pop culture. And so I wanted to ask how you incorporate those and what does or doesn't make like a good pop culture reference work.
I guess, you know, like a lot of like, I guess for me, like number one, like Star Wars was, you know, part of my growing up. And I feel like, you know, C-3PO in particular was my first seeing of like a feminized masculine character on screen. So like I hadn't seen queerness, you know, and like I'm an old man now. So when I saw it, it was like, you know, the cantina scene and everything. I was like, wow, like, this is amazing. Like, these aren't normal, you know, this is such a difference of what I've been seeing of men and women and ideas about how people should behave. So yeah, that's sort of what cemented that pop culture reference. And really, like, the story of Owen Hart is such a deeply Canadian story because, you know, before the WWE, there was Calgary Stampede and it got sold to Vince McMahon. You know, and it was like Owen Hart's dad that sold it. So having your son die in the ring that you essentially created, you know, helped start. And then so unceremoniously, you know, dragged off the ring after he died on it. You know, like to me, that is such a poem. Like, holy moly, that's a poem. And then Mike Tyson, you know, I have to have something in common, you know, or some experience that's rooted in the person. So Mike Tyson for me was the greatest lisper I'd ever seen. I'd never seen a lisper on television before, right? So he was my first, and I was like, wow, everybody's afraid of him. Like, that's amazing. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, I love that poem in particular. Like, I love it so much because it's a kind of a redemption story without excusing how he became, but like, you know, the Mike Tyson to me is so fascinating. And I remember when I first wrote that poem, it had a different ending. And then as he changed, the poem changed. And like, that's also the risk, right? Of like writing about people, you don't have control over people, right? Mike Tyson could be the worst person in the world next year, you know, and people will be like, why did you write such a nice poem about Mike Tyson? You know, I don't think he will. He's like, he's really turned a leaf. But yeah, just for, you know, an example, like that person could change, you know, and like your poem is now static. And so like that poem, if I'd published it back then, you know, I would be very upset that it was sitting in a thing because it was so unforgiving. But yeah.
Interesting. Okay. I said we would go to a reading after that question. And so I'm wondering if it'd be possible to get you to read the Mike Tyson poem because we were just talking about it.
Sure.
That'd be great.
Yeah. So I love this poem because, you know, like I say, it's, you know, I'm very obsessed with masculinity because I'm a trans masculine person, let's face it. And there it is, my first lisping hero. And you know, one story that a lot of masculine people don't hear are redemption stories, are stories of people coming back, are stories of people improving their lives after, you know, harming others. And I think those stories are super important, you know, honoring the harm that they've done, but honoring the fact that you can turn things around and you don't have to disappear. Because I feel like men are, you know, disappearing into these echo chambers and becoming worse. So I love having this poem to read to people. So my first lisping hero to be performed with ukulele finger picking. We called you champ, Mike Tyson. When you and I open up our mouths, they turn into bullseyes, and we are silent in our defense because words can be landmines. The first time I saw you unabashed, unapologetic on the microphone, you became my first lisping hero. I imagined us on my playground, bullies fleeing or earthquake footsteps. I tried to duck and dance like a butterfly alley, but you were no one's punching bag. Launched iron fists to the tune of 38 arrests before you hit age 13. The boxing world plucked you from reform school. Maybe you felt saved. I know how education can seem like the enemy, and for a boy targeted for his high-pitched, lispy voice, you probably felt relieved that the teacher would never call on you again. Your lisp never got better. Your voice never dropped. You put up your dukes, gave up on language, and let your dreams narrow. Before your mom died, she gave you to your boxing coach, Gus D'Amato, who polished you up like a custom auto, but he never could install any brakes. There was no bells in the bedrooms you strode into, no towels to be thrown in front of your thundering ways, raised to be a wild animal. You look calmest, wrestling with your Bengal tiger. Even your friends said you belonged in a cage. But Mike, you're as used to betrayal as getting punched in the gut. I mean, the man who could have protected you left when you were just 2 years old. There are no S sounds in Dad. You could have said it every day with a worry of retribution. Instead, you shouted it into barrel chests. It bounced back with the blank stares of men who loved you for your fists and the bags of money they bring. Maybe what you needed was a male embrace, not cut short by a bell. Now, in the wake of Holyfield's spat out ear, your empire crumbles, your 4-year-old daughter dies, your other children look at you in fear, and your beloved tiger paces behind some stranger's bars. The television calls you a monster, speaks of your failures, your crimes, your legacy of violence. Mike, I like your new heavyweight fight, the one called sobriety, as your daughter's easy laughter makes you a champion, the father who's there, the father who came back. I've written so many endings to your poem, Mike. Some were too kind, others damned you, but you grew in love and recovery. Some humans are capable of so much when we give them a chance to get up off the mat.
I love this poem. Thank you for that. That was a really fantastic reading.
Thank you.
I have so many questions about your work, but one of them that really strikes me as somebody who has read your book a couple times now is, how do you start these poems? Because, Charlie, often you reach these really cool conclusions and the endings just land. But I'm wondering, like, when you sit down to write a poem, what's the first thing you do?
I start in the morning. I usually am a morning writer because I have ADD. And, like, by the end of the day, I'm just like, what? What's that? What? essentially the budgie in the cage of man. Anyway, so I don't know. How do I start? I guess sometimes it's like with Mike, like I knew that was a poem I wanted to write. There was actually this Last Poet Standing Dwayne Morgan used to do in Toronto. Yeah. And you have, yeah, and you have, you do your poems in a boxing ring. And so I was like, and I've always loved Mike Tyson. I was like, you know what? Mike Tyson needs a love letter poem. And so it sat with me until one day. It just came out, and that's an unplanned. Usually I'm just like, holy fuck, it's coming, you know, like you know, giving birth to your poem or whatever. But normally I just sit at my computer sometimes, and I try and write every morning. Sometimes I'll just open up a book and put my finger on a page and look at whatever word I put my finger on. And that's the thing for that day. And sometimes that's how poems get created by me. And I do like a narrative poem. I'm not set on how to end it, though. Usually the poem shows me, a lot of my work shows me where it wants to go and how it wants to end. There are messages I want to give, but yeah, I don't, you know, I know what I want to hit. And by the time I get to the end, it's usually there waiting for me. It's like, this is how you end it. So I'm, yeah, you know, maybe I've got some poetry gods that like to come around and massage my brain every now and then to be really nice.
There you go. That's really cool. So yeah, so it's kind of like a matter of listening almost to where the poem wants to go, mm-hmm. and having that direct you. So okay, interesting, good to know. I guess we're kind of slowly approaching the end here. We still have some time left, but I'm wondering, Charlie, if I could ask you for a question that I could mm-hmm. ask my next episode's guest.
Okay. Has a poem ever come back to bite you?
Ooh, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. Okay, Charlie, I do this mean thing where I turn the question around, and now I will ask you. Charlie, has a poem ever come back to bite you?
Has a poem ever come back to bite me? Not. I'm just looking at these poems to see if it has. No, I'm very fucking careful in many ways. Like, I know who I wouldn't want to be bitten by, you know, so I don't write poems about them. In an earlier poem, like in an earlier work, you know, I think if people dug up my old work, I would have poems that would come back to bite me, because we've all gotten several memos since then about language, right? You know, like I, you know, I referred to a sex worker as a hooker before, right? And like, so whenever I see that book in someone's house, I'll like go and like sex worker, right? Like, update, you know. Yeah, I have a real fear of poems coming back to bite me. And sometimes I think it gets in the way of my work. Cause you're the audience is always physically there when I'm writing.
Right.
So I don't feel like I write in a cabin in the woods and nobody's ever gonna read it. I feel like I'm writing to be able to say it in front of a whole bunch of people. And so I'm really aware of where I can go and where I'd prefer not to go. Like, do you want to, you know, is this the sword you want to die on? Sometimes comes into mind when I have an idea for a poem that might be pushing a boundary that I might not be comfortable to push. But I feel like old work might. So, you know, if you really want to ruin me, go find my old books. I shouldn't put that on a podcast. No, I used to write poems as this character called Tits McGee. And like, maybe she was a little crass about things.
I'll just assume from the name that you might be right there. I don't know for sure though.
Yeah. She put out a greatest tits album, even. It was great.
That's fantastic. Wow. Yeah, really. Oh my gosh. Well, I wonder too though, like, you talked about almost like thinking about having your audience there as you're writing. And I wonder if that's something that comes with like being a spoken word poet as opposed to just somebody who's only publishing page poetry, because of the fact that, like, often when I talk to people on this show and from my own experience, it's easy to feel detached from your readers. Mm-hmm. And to not, like, really, it's hard to keep track and know, like, oh, this person read my book. It's maybe easier if they post on social media, but there's still going to be a lot of people that, like, you don't know if they read it or not. Or you don't know who mm-hmm. picked up that copy that you signed to Victoria, right? It could just be me. It could be some random other person. So it's maybe something that comes with being a spoken word poet and often having an audience visibly and physically right in front of you. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Like, yeah, I guess, you know, because it's like, you know, being in that audience and then also being like an arts organizer, you know, and just watching the effects of these, you know, poems on people. And yeah, I feel like, you know, I'm a sucker for the stage, and it shows up in my work in many ways.
Yeah, and it actually, it makes me wonder too, like, because you're also a musician, obviously. You're a performer, and music plays a big role in your performances. And well, we already talked about you playing with a sick band, so I mean, okay. But I wonder if there's like a lot of musicians too that have trouble with, or are often thinking of audiences first before, like, do you know what I mean? Especially in commercialized music, I would imagine, right, is probably like, that's a huge thing. But as somebody who's not a musician, like, I really don't know. But this is the first time I'm thinking about this.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I think it comes with that sort of like forewarning and awareness, I think, comes also with, you know, like, I, you know, when I'm not just representing myself when I'm up there. I mean, I'm representing my own experience and everything, but a lot of times I'll be the first, you know, trans person people see, you know, at these conferences or like whatever show I'm doing, you know, like, you know, at Michigan, I'm, you know, I was the only trans person that was out, that was there, you know? So there's a heaviness on it where you're like, I want to rep my, what I want to say and how I want to perform. And, but I also want to do right by not only, you know, by being someone who's, you know, someone who's in the trans community, and just realizing that, you know, if I get you to like me, you're going to like other trans people. You might think, you know, if I get you to like me, it means that the next trans person you encounter might be given more kindness and less fear. Yeah. As a part of my experience of putting my own work out there, whether it's spoken or written even.
Yeah, and that is unfortunately the way it works for a lot of people, is that what your work is representing is more than just yourself. It's the things that you align yourself with or that you identify as, and those things can be greater than, you know, just the poem that I'm writing right now. You know, it can be representative of so much more. So that's an extra weight that's added to people who are, you know, diverse writers or are in marginalized communities, that sort of thing. That, yeah, maybe I haven't put enough thought into before.
Yeah, this is going to be, this is all new territory for you. I mean, it's, you know, it's realizing that it's probably been territory for you forever, but now it's a different level.
Definitely. And like, because there's such a big difference, right, between like questioning things in your own head and then like suddenly publicly starting to write about them or talk about them like we are right now is very, very different. So it's interesting, the things that like I've become aware of, and honestly the biggest thing I've become aware of is white male privilege, because my God, I've been carrying it for 25 years and probably still can switch into that when I need to, which is a really weird way of looking at it. But realize, I guess, or I have realized anyway, the amount of things that change for me just from identifying as using a different pronoun. Completely different, and that I didn't even think about beforehand.
Yeah, it's wild. And even like, you know, like when I changed, you know, when I when my social media started to reflect my gender, it was so funny, because now, you know, like before I could joke at things as, you know, as a woman, you know, not that I was a woman, but like back when I was doing full-time drag as a woman, you know, I could say certain things and they're received differently. And then I, you know, but you know, when I'm on Facebook, all anybody knows is that I'm a white guy named Charlie. And I'm like, oh, I actually gotta like, I got to really think about where I'm coming in from now. Like, this isn't a joke, you know, like this is you know, it's, you know, it's not like I wanted to be a white man. You know, I always say, like, you know, ever since I realized that the only way to survive and thrive in this old world is to become a white man. So I became one. But you know, that like, that's, you know, essentially a big joke, 'cause I'm a white trans guy. So I'm like bottom barrel white. disabled white trans masculine person, but I'm still, you know, I still definitely, you know, my whiteness gets me into places and into an economic structure that's built around whiteness. But coming at it, like, but it's such a funny negotiation, like for trans masculine people, you know, because you're like trying not to be, louder than women, but you're also trying to like be masculine. Like it's just, it's, yeah, it's essentially like how I said in transilience, I always feel like I'm walking well behind women so as not to like worry them, but like also being afraid of men at the same time. In many similar ways that women are. It's a weird world.
We love it. We love a liminal space. We're kind of approaching the end here, Charlie. Before we take off, could I get you to read one more poem for us?
Sure. Maybe I'll do the Dear C-3PO.
Cool.
I feel like it says a lot about masculinity and like even like war right now. Not that I've been in war. But yeah, anyway. With love to the Ukraine. Dear C-3PO, so the liner notes are to be accompanied by a ukulele and musical saw loop pedal build done to the tune of Can't Take My Eyes Off of You by Bob Crew and Bob Gaudio. Dear C-3PO, I always thought that you were gay. I imagine that there was a little glorious hole somewhere in R2-D2, and when you made love, he made those happy sounds. Maybe he would turn his head all around to see you try and read joy in your manufactured face. I always thought you a top, that R2-D2 hummed love songs that didn't sound pre-programmed or desperate or othering. C-3PO was your golden exterior made up of melted down wedding rings tossed into vats at training schools. The sheddings of those ready to die. These galaxy warriors who laughed at what made you feminine, which sounds like hesitation, which sounds like we are afraid to feel. How you must have keened every time your lover went to war, became a plug in another machine as unprotected as a jet wing. Your gold-plated face never told us. Behind the joke was a man in love with a soldier. I felt your tears, my sweet, though your face betrayed nothing.
There we go. Charlie Petch, folks. Charlie, thank you so much for your time today. It's been so great chatting with you and getting to know more about you and the book.
Yeah. I'm so happy that you read it and you read it twice. And I'm so happy for your lovely news, a celebration of who you are. That's amazing. And I'm so happy if this book helped you connect to yourself as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it came at a very good time in my life, I think. So I appreciate you writing it. I know it wasn't just for me. It was for many people, including probably yourself to some extent.
Oh, sure.
But it meant a lot to me to be able to read it at the time that I did. So thank you for your writing. It was
great. Oh, thanks. I'm only crying a little bit. Only a little bit.
Okay, we'll end it here. We'll throw it back to me doing a little sign off. But thanks again, Charlie, for your time.
Thank you. It was so nice to talk to you.
Okay, there you go. That was me chatting with Charlie Petch. Charlie, thank you for your time. I thanked you a bunch at the end of the episode and after the episode, but it meant a lot to be able to talk about a work that's had this profound of an impact on me at this time in my life and that I've been thinking through a lot, because I don't know if you could pick up on this in the interview, but I feel like Charlie and I have a lot in common. Not just the gender identity searching thing, but also a lot of the interests that we have align and a lot of our experiences do too. And so it meant a lot to be able to sit down and talk with them and connect on that level. And I hope we can connect again, Charlie, if you're listening to this. If you're listening to this and you're not Charlie, or even if you are and you just want to hear more Page Fright, let me tell you, it's super easy to make this whole thing between you and I official. All you got to do is subscribe to the show. You can do it wherever you're listening to this podcast. There should be a way to subscribe. And almost more importantly, there should be a way to leave a review. Reviewing the show helps me figure out what the heck I'm doing here, but it also helps get the eyes of random people on the work of the poets I talk to, which is, as you know by now, the ultimate goal of what I'm doing here. So if you can leave a review, it's always appreciated. Show some love on Twitter and Instagram and so on. these monthly episodes have been really fun, and it's really nice to be able to interact with folks in this capacity once a month, as opposed to every week as I started, or every 2 weeks. It's just been very refreshing to take some time for myself and return as I need to. And it's given me more time to grow between episodes too, and work on my own writing and come back with what I hope are new questions. You get to 70 some odd episodes and you start running out of questions for yourself to ask. So there's a lot of generic stuff that comes up again, but I hope that there was something in this interview that stuck with you. Without much else to add, I'm going to take off and fight the snow here in Vancouver, go get some groceries. I hope you're staying warm and safe wherever you are. My name is Andrew French. I'm on Twitter @TheAndrewFrench, and this, of course, this has been PageWrite.